This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Daniel, Janine, we are back with the Eater Upsell.
I got it. Yeah, we got a good slate of stories here. I'm really excited. Should we introduce ours? Your name is Amanda Clute.
I'm Amanda Clute. I'm the editor-in-chief of Eater.
I'm a producer, and my name is Daniel Janine.
Every week on this show, we talk about our favorite food stories.
We sure do. Important,
and maybe some
funny.
Yeah.
Anecdotal.
Get some experts in here.
Oh,
have a good time.
Yeah.
And then we get out.
And we bounce out. We separate all the stories with the sound of a ding, like this. Side note, Martha doesn't like the ding, but we'll talk about it later.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This week on the show, we are going to be talking about the latest in food TV.
The latest in food TV, some very questionable new plate designs.
Uh-huh.
What is going on with delivery drivers and tipping? There's a big scandal. As always, if you love the show, please remember to subscribe to it on whatever platform and rate us 5 stars. Give us a comment.
And also, if you live in the New York area, come to our summit on Saturday, July 27th. It is going to be fantastic. We are going to be talking about the future of the restaurant industry. There's going to be all kinds of food and drink, $60 all in. It's going to be amazing. Also at the summit, we are going to give a sneak peek at the new direction of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to be called, can we say what it's going to be called?
Sure.
Yeah. It's going to be called Eater's Digest. It's going to be a little different from what you've been hearing, but
not
in a scary way,
not
too different. So stay tuned for the first episode on August 9th in this feed. Hope to see you there. Let's get into it. Daniel.
Heyo.
There's a big story this week about DoorDash, one of those delivery companies, stealing tips from their workers. This is not new news, but I think it became a conversational piece again because the New York Times did this big interactive piece where a writer went around as a delivery person for a day to talk about what it's like.
I think he did 32 hours as a delivery person.
Yeah, and he did all the different services.
I think it's an interesting piece if you haven't read it. In order to make a more than, say, $10 or $12 an hour, you have to figure out how each of the individual apps work.
Mm-hmm.
Uber Eats, Caviar, DoorDash, Postmates. They have all these bonuses that are going if you do a certain amount of deliveries in a certain amount of time.
Yep.
You get $10. So he says that you have to both be athletic and have the cognitive quickness of a day trader,
right,
in order to
say yes to the right things
in order to get, you know, he said there are some ninjas out there who are doing like $20 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a strange combination of physical labor and, I don't know, quickness of mind. It's like it's a crazy, scary thing.
Right, right, right.
DoorDash guarantees that you will make $6.85 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If someone tips you $3, then that $3 will be added into your $6.85. So you still only make $6.85, and DoorDash itself will only pay you $3.85.
Yeah.
People were really mad about it. DoorDash's CEO was outspoken when the policy first came to light, claiming that it helped balance the wages for all of the drivers.
Mm-hmm.
or all the delivery people. He was claiming that it was actually a policy generated out of fairness.
Right, right, right.
But it's crazy. I mean, a dumb thing that one of these companies can do, especially because none of them are profitable yet,
mm-hmm,
is steal tips. Like,
right,
people have kind of come to terms with the fact that this gig economy is completely evil and is, you know, it creates all these jobs for people and then it gets them hooked on these jobs. They don't learn any new skills and then they just lower the wages.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they're just like breaking even hour to hour and they don't have anything else to do. Like, that is pure evil, but people have kind of started to accept that. You know, people like there are some things you can do, tip in cash so that the companies can't take anything out. But now if once people heard that they were actually digging into their tips, that was a new huge battlefront in which to attack these companies.
Right. And even though it's been out there before, I think this just like really brought it to a new audience and a new level of outrage. I think what was more disturbing to me was this line in here where he says, Postmates says its couriers in New York City average $18.50 an hour, but it counts only the time when a courier is out on an order as part of that hour. So all the time between when you're just waiting for an order to come in don't count.
No.
So really, you could have a 12-hour day, but you're only actually making money for like this certain part of it. And you don't, it's not like you know that when it's going to be happening and when it's not going to be happening, and you can go do something.
Well, this is the biggest problem with the whole thing is that you're never a Postmates employee.
Right.
You're a Postmates employee once you accept that order. For that hour, you're considered a Postmates employee.
Right. And for that hour, you make your $18 and then like whatever, you have to go do something else.
What was interesting, and I don't mean to say this in defense of these companies at all, but what was interesting in this piece, and I guess it is kind of general knowledge about these companies right now, is that when they started, some people were making, I think it was written in there that some people were making up to $2,000 a week because there were so many jobs and the bonuses were so high. And again, not to justify it at all, but there's just been so much interest in these jobs because of the way the economy is and because of how easy it is to pick them up and just start doing them, that the huge influx of riders, of bikers and delivery people has made it easy for the company to squeeze them.
Right. Does it change your view on using these companies?
I will say one thing that I often get flack for, especially in the office when there's like a thunderstorm or it's a terrible day outside.
Oh, you order.
And people are like, are you ordering caviar? Are you ordering Uber Eats? You're an awful person.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm generous with tipping and I tip in cash. Mm-hmm. But right now, I think there are people who want those jobs. I don't think not using them on harsh weather days or not using them at all benefiting the people that are working for them right now. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm super confused about it because there's a reason the services are so successful, and that is it's a service that a lot of people want. I want my Midtown Munch in downtown.
It makes people addicted to this unrealistic thing that's inflated by venture capital.
Yeah.
You know, like
we're part of the problem too. Like
people getting the delivery are part of the problem. People using all these services are part of the problem because it's this cheap thing that it feels like magic, like, oh, I can just like get the sandwich delivered to me for like $12 total. It's like, it shouldn't be that cheap.
Well, even when you think about the fact that the sandwich is $8, I don't think it's fair to pay someone, even if it is $4, for their 20-minute commute.
Right. All these venture-backed companies where the profits aren't real. The money isn't real.
Right.
And so they built up this thing. It becomes a necessary part of your life. So then they do have a business.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like a fakery to get it there.
Fake it till you make it. I mean, it's very inspiring. But hey, don't mean to put you on the spot, Amanda Clute. But, you do run a large food media company covering these businesses. Do you not have a political opinion about them? Do you not think that, like, If it was up to you, would we all stop using them?
If it were up to me, yes.
So just stop.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah. I think so.
So why don't you be more outspoken about that?
I should do it. I haven't thought about it enough. Maybe I'll write an op-ed. Like, just stop. Maybe I should stop. I don't really use them that much. Seamless like once a month.
But Seamless and Grubhub are different because with them, they're just giving restaurants an opportunity to deliver their own food.
No. They shouldn't really be lumped in the same way. They've done their own shady shit, though.
They've done their own shady shit.
But it's less about...
They're not squeezing drivers.
No, it's a different kind of model.
Right.
And they have built up a different kind of business.
What happens to all these people who are relying on it right now as a source of income if we did actually organize some kind of boycott?
Right.
There's
like,
would there be all of the gig
economy workers? What do they do when we take the system away?
I feel like this is a question that people ask all the time.
And I'm sure a smarter person can answer that. But I would say there should be jobs for them.
It would have to come in conjunction with another political movement.
Yeah, but also I mean, it's not like we have high unemployment right now. Like, maybe that's a simplified look at it, but there should be something for these people.
One of the reasons we don't have high employment unemployment right now is because of all these gig economy jobs, which are technically counted as towards the employment percentage. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Anyway, it's a topic that I don't think is going to go away for a long time. As long as there is technology that is very good and very efficient at moving people around and, mm-hmm. and having people be in an exact place at a certain time and use physical labor, but use that so efficiently that you can have someone who's just walking around do 20 jobs in an hour. Mm-hmm. Technology is going to keep squeezing these people. It's going to keep figuring out how to use them for various tasks. So, I mean, it is something that scares the shit out of me, to be honest.
I think what could happen is, like, you could still have regulation that could regulate these companies and have them treat their workers fairly. And then you can still have the convenience. You just have to pay the real price for it. Mm-hmm. Because if they are paying their employees fairly, they're going to raise the price for you.
Right.
So I feel like that's probably going to be the answer if we can actually get there. But it seems like the government in general is trying to look into a lot of these big tech companies, and I feel like this is going to be part of it as well. Like, they're going to focus on Facebook and Amazon, et cetera, but I think this is all part of a similar problem.
Cool. Well, we should be better at moving this forward.
You're right. Thought leadership, Daniel.
Next up on the show, we are joined by Jaya Saxena. Jaya, welcome to the program.
Hey.
That's the first time I've said program.
Program.
You wrote a piece a couple days ago called "These Horrible Portion Control Plates Are a Symptom of a Bigger Problem." But I want to talk about the smaller problem first.
Of the horrible plates?
Yeah. I love products and I love, you know, Crate and Barrel and all these kinds of things. So tell me what happened. What are
these
plates?
So the plates are supposedly playful ways to manage your portions.
Yeah.
And so the main one that everyone was getting riled up over had three concentric circles, one that said skinny jeans, one that said favorite jeans, and then one that said mom jeans.
Ooh.
Which is supposedly, and then there are other ones where
they corresponded to the
smallest portion or size being skinny jeans, and then the largest one being mom jeans.
Right.
I believe the idea being that, oh, if you want to fit into your skinny jeans, eat the little ones, and then if you want to fit into like baggy mom jeans, eat the big one.
I think if you
it's very
eat this
badly
if you're,
thought out is like the main part of it.
Right.
Is that one, these are just styles of jeans you're talking about. And like all the other things that they did, there was one where the innermost circle said feed me and the outermost said feed bag.
Mm.
There was a wine glass where there was a lower line that said on the lips and the upper one said on the hips.
What does that one mean?
I don't know what on the lips mean. Yeah. I assume that they mean if you drink too much wine, it'll go to your hips. But it also, the bad design of this is that these plates require you to do so much work to figure out what the hell the joke is.
Also, like, mom jeans are really popular amongst people of all sizes.
Mom jeans are super popular. Yeah. A lot of these plates don't make any sense. And then there are a bunch of ones that, a different awful thing. There was a wedding line where they had rocks glasses for whiskey, and one of them said, like, the lower one said having a ball, and then the upper one said ball and chain, and one said I do, and then the upper one said I did, like as if you got too drunk and got married. And I'm just like, what?
So that's wild. Where did you find out about these?
I saw there was another writer who was tweeting about them, Allie Ward, I believe was her name, being mm-hmm. like, this is horrible. They were initially being carried by Macy's, and I believe her joke was like, can I get Macy's to just like burn all of these because these are terrible. It sort of brought up this other conversation about portion control and mm-hmm. dieting and how sort of joking about it and doing this outside of a nutritionist guidance can really be triggering for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you were seeing some people who are genuinely upset by it?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that, you know, a lot of nutritionists, if you are trying to lose weight, there are nutritionists who suggest portion control being
plates.
Like a way to do that. And there are plates that you can buy that like show you how much a portion of like chicken or rice or whatever these suggestions
really?
Are. There are.
Like a Seder plate?
Basically, yeah. Or like a little cafeteria like sectioned off tray. But even then, it's something where like you might be aware, dieting is very fraught mm-hmm. in society. And so plates like this could probably exacerbate a lot of disordered eating. You can really panic and think, I'm not allowed to eat anything outside of this small little circle.
Yeah.
And it's just an unfortunate reminder to people who maybe don't need that in their lives.
What happened to the company? Did Macy's pull the plates?
Macy's pulled the plates. Macy's responded to the original viral tweet saying that they had miscalculated, which, like, I don't think they miscalculated.
Well, no, in fairness, favorite jeans should be like a little bit wider. The dimensions were wrong.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, we need to go back. The company that makes the plates is called Portions, P-O-U-R.
Have started with the beverages.
I think they started with the beverages, yeah. And then it was just like bad puns all around.
Yeah.
Macy's said that they were pulling the plates, but it's like you can still buy them. I'm sure they're still available at other stores. It's just that Macy's caught on that people were mad that they were carrying these and decided not to carry them.
Right. But, well, it's amazing that Macy's is actually listening to the online conversation.
Yeah.
I don't mean it's like amazing. Good for them. But I just mean like.
Yeah, and I think it's something that, you know, for better or for worse, I think Twitter, like, you can call out a brand sometimes, and if it gets enough attention and brands think it's going to cut into their bottom line, they have the ability to act. You know, Macy's wants to make money, and if people are going to be too mad at them to spend money at Macy's, they're going to do whatever they want, whatever they can to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Have you seen any restaurant or product able to talk about dieting or talk about consumption in a way that isn't problematic or isn't unhealthy?
I'm not sure. I think it's one of those things where even if you try your very best,
yeah.
It is just there are so many people with eating disorders or have been encouraged by various points of society to stay skinny at all costs that, you know, it gets really difficult to talk about it in the first place. And I think a lot of brands are moving away from talking about dieting to talking about quote unquote wellness or health.
I like TGI Fridays. They always have a section in the menu that's like
the light. Yeah.
Light. But it's gone through so many iterations. It was originally like light or fat free. And now it's like healthy active.
Yeah. I want to go back to the ones that they had, the Diet Delight section on a diner menu, where it's just like a scoop of cream cheese on top of a bed of lettuce.
Oh, yeah, I missed that. Yeah. Oh, and also they do like save the calories, not the flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and there's so many things like that. And I mean, I get, you know, again, like it's good to have options for people. But I think that, yeah, like the whole conversation is just so fraught. And I don't think anyone brand or chef or restaurant is going to like single-handedly cure this.
Daniel, I was writing a newsletter, as I do usually Friday afternoons right before my deadline, and I came to you for advice.
Can I just tell you something about your newsletter?
Yeah.
First of all, it's great.
Thank you.
Everyone should subscribe to it. Just search Amanda Clute newsletter.
Yep.
But one thing you do that super is annoying to me is like you have more to do than I do.
Uh-huh.
And you are more efficient at doing all those things.
Efficiency is my superpower.
So I get annoyed when we talk about something in a meeting and then you're like 7 hours later, you're like, hey, make sure to, you know, or like, hey, can you pass off that in thing? And it's a thing that I wouldn't even think that you were concerned about. And you make sure to cover all your bases. I do like that you sprint every Friday. You seem to have no idea what you're going to write for your newsletter.
It's
and you're just
true.
Like, hey, anyone have any ideas?
It's like, but literally anyone give me an idea for the, like, I have to do this.
Yeah.
Soon.
Like, maybe you should cut sandwiches in thirds instead of halves.
But see.
So that, I like that because it is a human moment.
Also, I think it makes for more honest newsletter experience.
Are you justifying this right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so I came to you for ideas on Friday because I wanted to tackle the idea of being a regular and how to be a better regular.
At a restaurant.
At a restaurant or coffee shop or whatever. Reason being, I moved to this new neighborhood a few months ago, actually almost a year ago, and I thought because I had maternity leave coming up that I would be a regular at all the places because I'd be able to go all the time. Versus now, like when I'm working, like you don't have time to go to all the places, and I always want to try new places. So I thought, okay, 4 months, I'm just going to pick a few places and go constantly. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be in for the rest of my time living in this neighborhood. Turns out, no dice.
What do you mean? Okay. What does it mean to be a regular?
Like, what do you get out of it? When do you achieve it?
Yeah, what is being a good...
When they know who you are, when they recognize you, maybe they know your name, maybe they know what you like, any kind of, like, recognition whatsoever.
So you thought, I've got a good amount of time here.
Yeah.
I'm going to be able to establish myself in a couple places.
Put in my time.
And you don't feel like you did.
No.
You don't get smiles when you walk in, you don't...
Not more than the average person is walking in.
So do you think this... So you came to me... Well, let's stay on you. Do you think you're not someone who is good at it?
Yes.
Because you're putting in the time.
I didn't realize until later that it's not just about time. Mm-hmm. There's an actual strategy to it. Mm-hmm. And I opened the newsletter with my friend JJ because he is known by everyone in the neighborhood. He's just the most friendly guy in the world. And I think that's really it.
Yeah.
Because he's super friendly, gets to know everybody. Oh, it's not just that you need...
I love that guy.
He's like, just don't wear deodorant or get a funny hat. Like, have a way for them to remember you, which probably is a way in.
Yeah.
Like, if you have something distinct about you versus, like, I'm just some lady with a baby getting coffee every day.
I mean, that's...
And not being friendly.
Yeah.
You know, not being mean.
Do you not think you're friendly?
I'm just not... I don't make an effort. That's what I'm learning.
Yeah.
As I want to become a regular, I need to... introduce myself.
But you do things where you have to be good with sales teams and you have to be good with, you know, dealing sales people and
I can turn it on if I know that's what I need to do, but okay. I'm going to these coffee shops and just being like, one coffee please, thank you very much, I'm gonna go sit and read my book now and not talk to anybody and then leave and do the same thing the next day.
So you want to be a better regular
anyway. Like JJ, you are a regular a number of places.
Yeah.
And so are a lot of other people on staff. So I asked everybody and got a lot of good takeaways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So can you share with our listeners some of your favorites?
Some of my favorite moves?
Yeah. What are your moves?
I think the thing that I told you right away was, well, first of all, sitting alone is a huge thing. Sitting alone at the bar, it's much easier to interact with someone because, like, you want someone who's going to loiter around where you are and linger when they have nothing to do.
Yeah.
A server is never just going to hang beside your table. That's why the bar is, that's full stop. If you can't sit at a bar, it's never going to work. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I don't desire to be a regular. It just falls on me. You know?
Your burden.
I think also I have like a very, it's not an on or off thing. Like sometimes I'm just like, I want to find someone to talk to. And then sometimes I don't. But when I do, oh boy, look out.
Right, right. Like it's your authentic self is just chatting with people all the time.
Listening.
And
I like
mine,
to hear.
I just want to like get my coffee and sit down and be alone.
Right.
I just want them to be like, hey, Amanda.
Right.
How's your day going? And then like move on.
Let's go
and
with.
And that's why I'll never get it.
No, but you like people and you're curious sometimes. I think you
I just need to.
Yeah. Coffee shops are a lot harder.
Coffee shops are harder.
Let's talk about. Okay. So I'll give you an example. There's a restaurant near my apartment called Atla that I go to way too much. Mm-hmm. It's great, but I'm just there way too much and it's kind of expensive. Very expensive.
Yeah.
Building regular status there, I would just go and I managed to hit like when this certain bartender was there, I managed to always be there when he was there, just the way it worked out. So if I were to recreate that, I would make sure to pick someone because the problem with a lot of New York restaurants where you have tons of staff, you may go all the time, but you need someone to recognize you. You need someone to know that you're the person who's there. Like even now when I go for brunch, I'm like, Jesus, I'm starting new. You know, no one knows who I am.
Starting
Do you not
scratch.
Know what kind of stature I have at nighttime here?
I put in so many hours at this place.
For real.
Well, that's a tip that a lot of people gave me that I had never thought of before, which is like home in on a person, figure out when their schedule is.
Yeah.
Like it's almost stalkery, but it's actually going to work out for you. Mm-hmm. And just go when they're there, get to know them, and then it grows from there.
Another thing I told you is this only works if you will actually do it. But when you are negotiating your order with the bartender, you can say, I want three things and a drink, and I genuinely would like for you to pick them for me. But if you do this and then you change up and then you say, oh, I was actually hoping for this thing, whatever, don't do it. If you're going to do that, then
this is the weirdest
you actually
tip.
Have to lock it in. No, no, no. It's not a weird tip. It's a great tip.
It's a very specific weird tip.
Because then they will then they're like, oh, this person trusts my opinion and taste. And often you're going to get, like, I would rather get the things that they think are the best than whatever my eye is drawn to. So that's a good one. And then they're a little bit more invested in how you feel about the thing. That's going to be, you're just looking for points of banter.
And when you're sitting alone at the bar or counter, no phones, right? Someone said, like, don't look at your phone.
I mean, what are you going to do then? You have to look at your phone a little bit. Let me think. What else? I don't know. Maybe just order the same thing a lot so you can become like the chicken soup guy.
Well, someone also on the reservations front, if you are going to be sitting at a table and with somebody else, make reservations all the time so they can track you and know you're coming in. So like letting the, you know, resi service do part of the work for them. Make a reservation on the way out. So maybe go once and be like, oh, I'm really excited to come back here. This was so great. Let me make a reservation so they remember you and it shows that you're committed.
Another little trick, see if you can acquire a business card of someone, whether it's your bartender or manager, and just say, like, just as if you're writing a review, just be like, hey, I had this person serve me very, like, tonight. They were really lovely, and I ate this, and everything was great. I just wanted to say thank you. Good chance they will respond and say, really appreciate you letting me know. Let me know next time you want to come in.
Cool. Love that.
Yeah.
Listeners, if you have tips... on how to be regular.
Being regular.
Or if you, like me, have also been frustrated by your lack of ability to get to this regular status and want to get there, email us. upsell@eater.com.
Oh, yeah.
As we do sometimes on this show, we are bringing in our pop culture editor and expert, Greg Morabito. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hey, Amanda. Hey, Dan. How are you guys doing?
Great. I have a few burning questions, a few shows I really want to talk to you about.
Yeah, let's get into it.
I want to start, I know this might sound passe, but I want to talk about Stranger Things. There's one very prominent food tie-in. It involves Coca-Cola and New Coke.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about New Coke and Stranger Things? And we are not going to give anything away for those of you who have not watched it yet. This is not a spoiler.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a big part of Stranger Things, especially this season, has to do with nostalgia. But, you know, as Netflix has explained in so many ways, the target audience for Stranger Things is like teenagers. And it's set in the 80s. So any sort of nostalgic stuff that's in the show, and there's a ton of references to 80s pop culture and things like that, you know, are references to things that came out and existed like before the target audience was even sort of born or had any sort of understanding of the world. And one of the things that they mention very prominently in one scene is New Coke, which was this product that came out in the mid 80s as the new formula for Coca-Cola that was pretty much universally reviled. And it kind of became this joke and sort of a shorthand for, like, what is a failed product, a product that nobody likes? It's New Coke. Well, I don't know if that many, you know, Gen Z viewers or even younger millennials will kind of know what that is. But they put it in the show, and one character is really, really likes it and sort of defends it in one scene. And, you know, part of that reason is that there is a partnership between Netflix and Coca-Cola. And they actually brought back New Coke in sort of a limited stock to tie in with the release of Stranger Things. But the scene where the character does defend New Coke, it does feel a little bit out of place. I don't know. What did you think, Amanda? Did you see it?
And I knew this was happening because I had read the coverage leading up to it, that New Coke, there was going to be this product placement, which I thought, first of all, was already weird. But the fact that there was a whole dialogue about it where they stopped the action of the show and talk about the Coke and whether it's good or not or whatever. It's like, that's crazy.
It's so strange, especially because I feel like they're trying to like rewrite the history of it a little bit. Because if the joke was just that, like, oh, what is this stuff? It's disgusting. I don't want to drink it. Like that would be, you know, culturally appropriate. That would make sense because that was the world's reaction to this new product. Everyone hated it, you know, but instead, they're trying to make it seem like, no, Coca-Cola is this awesome brand that was in the 80s. And they had this thing that was really cool, that's so cool in the 80s that the cool kids, your favorite stars of Stranger Things, like one of them's really into it, you know? So yeah. I don't know.
That's insane
to me. A lot of marketing muscle.
Yeah, it's also strange. It's funny because I feel like the trend has been the opposite for so long. Like if you watch 90s movies, you'll see so much product placement. Like if you watch... Yeah. a movie, any movie, you'll just see like a Dunkin' Donuts box. Like, I haven't seen that kind of thing in so long. And now just to see these Cokes everywhere, and it's a modern brand that's paying them money to do it. It's not like them putting Orange Julius in the mall to make it seem authentic. This is like actually a partnership where Coke is paying them. It's just a little curious.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually kind of learned a lot about this sort of deal. So there's a number of brands, both food and non-food brands, that appear in Stranger Things season 3. And a lot of these were sort of just handshake, like, yes, we would love to have your brand in our show, and we'd love to work with you here. And, you know, we're not going to exchange money, but we will make money off of the sale of any co-branded products. Mm-hmm. I think that was like one of the deals with Coca-Cola. So it's kind of like, you know, I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine. But also, like, they did have to make these deals to help fund the show, because it's like, you know, every episode is like an hour long special effects palooza, and it's 10 hours long, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had to make these partnerships with brands, and many of like Burger King's in it. Eggo is in it. Slurpees or Big Gulps are in it. So they had to make these deals to like be able to produce the most expensive TV show ever, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's also an ice cream shop.
There's an ice cream shop in the and show. They have a partnership with Baskin Robbins as part of this deal. So it's kind of a brand of palooza, I'd say.
So do you think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this?
I think that there's always been product placement, and Netflix in particular, they're being a little bit more conservative with how they spend money these days. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more stuff like that popping up in some of their like marquee shows.
I have another show I want to ask you about. It's called Taco Chronicles. I'm a huge fan. Can you explain what it is and why it's so awesome?
Yeah, it's this unusual arrival, I'd say, from Netflix, because it's from Netflix Latin America. It's their Latin American division. And it's basically like Chef's Table, or the spin-off of Chef's Table, street food. But every episode is about a different style of tacos. And it's entirely a Spanish language series, although there are a few scenes that are in LA. But mostly it explores regional taco styles. It's like very beautifully shot. There are a lot of, and there's some like food experts and writers and stuff that are talking heads. But mostly it's just showing these taqueros, sometimes at very famous taquerias, sometimes just in home kitchens, sort of plying their trade. And it's just fun and gorgeous and cool. But there is like one element that sets it apart, I think, from the rest of the culinary documentary series pack, which is that, and it took me a while to figure out that this is actually what was happening, but there's a slight element of magic realism to it, because the tacos narrate each episode.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And so, it's a different narrator for each one.
And so in the first one, I think it's like Al Pastor, you know, but it's like, I am salty. I go great with a little bit of pineapple. Like, and everyone in Mexico loves me. And it took me a while to be like, what? Who's saying?
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
The taco. So it's totally kooky. And I love it. It's not overbearing, and it's not too distracting. It's just this little ripple that runs through the show that makes it different, I think, from a lot of shows that are similar to it. I would love to see more of these culinary docuseries from other Netflix markets that are not made in America or, you know, Europe, because they translate so well. They're universal, and it's just like very cool to specifically look at one dish for an entire series.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for catching us up on all the important food TV out there.
And for watching all of it.
Oh, yeah. No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, guys. I'll catch you guys later.
Thanks, Greg.
Amanda, last week at the very end of the show, after the end credits, I think, you were like, hey, if anyone has any funny stories about weird things that diners tell you often, email us. And we got a funny email from a guy named Guy Ravid or Guy Ravid. Either way, great name.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this man owns a barbecue restaurant in California called Smokeyard. And he says that there's an interesting phenomenon there where guests feel the need to tell him how they do their barbecue at home. He says, imagine ordering a filet at a steakhouse and then asking to talk to the chef or manager so you can say, well, the way I do it is, I've obviously smoked hundreds of briskets or hundreds of blah, 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 lots. He's cooked a lot of food. Yet everyone with a backyard barbecue contraption feels the need to tell me the way they do it. Anyway, thanks for the great show.
In the South, I would not be surprised for this to be happening because people, you know, are more passionate about it there.
Wow.
Don't you think?
Well, with barbecue specifically.
Yeah.
Sure. So I think there's two ways of looking at this. One, there are people who really think, there's like a camp of people who are like, I really know how to make barbecue. Mm-hmm. Here's how, like when I do it, I hold my temperature, my low smoke at 212 or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then there's probably other people who are like, I'm an amateur. Here's how I tried it the other day. I used like ginger ale and it was delicious.
Well, I think barbecue is just something that people love to obsess over and talk about.
Yeah.
And they think it's like part of the allure of it. So they don't think they're hurting his feelings. They think like, let's all share.
I think some people think they probably do it better.
Right.
Most people, it is very easy to explain to someone else how you do your barbecue because there are, mm-hmm. everything is incredibly scientific, but you can say there are like four steps.
Yeah.
What's your marinade?
You can geek out over it.
How long? Right.
Versus like searing a steak. How long are you going to talk about that? You know, like a 1 minute conversation? But you could talk about barbecue for hours.
I think that this is a greater phenomenon, though, because I know that I have an impulse whenever I go to a restaurant, to be like, have you thought about doing this?
Really?
Well, if I'm friends with someone who owns a restaurant or is a chef.
I would never.
How dare you? So I
stopped
doing that. To a chef who had a Taiwanese restaurant, I once asked, you know, are you going to do bubble tea? Or like, you should do bubble tea or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then I was just 5 minutes later, I was just like, bubble tea was invented in Taiwan. It is huge. And like, this guy fucking knows.
He doesn't need you to tell him.
He doesn't need me to suggest the most famous thing coming out of a country.
Right.
But I will say that talking to chefs, sometimes when people have recommendations, people are generally like you. They are They would never impose on someone with their, you know, limited knowledge of the kitchen, whatever. But like, people are pumped to get those suggestions. I think.
There's a middle ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of times people ask for feedback and really do want to know, especially when a restaurant is new.
Not enough people are critical. I almost think this should be a separate segment because like this is actually a really interesting thing to talk about. What is the appropriate way of giving criticism to chefs at a restaurant, especially from people like you, maybe occasionally me, who they're super interested in hearing from, right? Like you're not a critic, but you are a tastemaker. Hello. Yeah. But like if I'm opening a restaurant and you're there, I want to know everything you think about a restaurant. I would love for you to fill out like a scorecard.
Give me a really intensive survey.
And I'm sure you're someone
to be very honest.
Who is not totally like if you eat something that you don't love, unless it's someone I feel like you know well, you would never be like, yeah, this didn't really work for me for these reasons.
Yeah, unless they're asking me very specifically.
Right.
Like really honest feedback about this dish. What did you think? We've been testing it out.
Right.
And then I would say. But otherwise, if they're like, how was it? I'd be like, everything was great. Thanks so much. Excited for your restaurant opening.
It's a thing that I do when I like a place.
Yeah.
If I think, I mean, this is so terrible of me, but if I think a place is just shot, I'll be like, everything was great. But if I think, if I've had, you know, five or six things and two of them were cool ideas, but for me, they didn't work for whatever. I'll just go and tell them. I'll be like, this didn't work because of this for me. I loved everything. I think what you're doing is brilliant. And people have been really appreciative and I've been banned from very few restaurants.
I think that's a good way of going about it.
Yeah.
If you have an opinion on this, email us.
If you
want us to fill out a very intensive survey about what you're doing, we will do it for you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Eater Upsell. If you liked the episode, make sure to subscribe to the show, rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use, and check in next week for something else that is new and fun. Amanda, any closing words? You're a tiny bit hungover and you are mad at that hangover because it's just a 2-drink hangover, which I understand.
It's a 4-drink hangover.
You said it was 2.
No, 4. I had 2 at one place and then 2 at another place.
That's a fair.
It's a little surprising to me.
Enough to be hungover. 1 drink, I won't be hungover. But between 2 and 5, my hangover is the same.
Yeah. I've heard this theory from you before.
I thought you were going to say from an expert.
Either 1 or 6.
Yeah. So.
1 or 6, Dan.
1 or 6, Dan. Are you going to booze at the summit, which is tomorrow?
I'm going to be chill at the summit. I'm going to booze after the summit.
Ooh. You're going to have a bunch after? You're going to have a night?
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to let loose.
Yeah, if anyone wants me to buy them dinner, tomorrow night is the night to ask me.
Wow.
Unless you're listening to this on Sunday and then it was too late. You missed it. Thank you so much for listening to The Eater Upsell. The Eater Upsell is hosted by me, Amanda Clute, and Daniel Janine. We have a producer. Her name is Martha Daniel. She is fantastic.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.